Tale of Two Countries. Today we're going to concentrate on Iceland, a country which has a very high GDP, very low crime rate, is well thought of in the international community as being very safe for any kind of white-collar crimes or any kind of financial fraud. But as they say, looks can be deceiving. Good afternoon. As always, I'd like to welcome you to my White Collar Crime and Fraud podcast. I'm your host, Gene Tausk. And this is a two-part episode. And I've titled it A Tale of Two Countries. We're going to examine two countries over the next two episodes. The first one, the one we'll be discussing today, has an international reputation as a very, very safe country in which to do business, a very safe country to visit, a country with a low crime rate, a country that by all standards, certainly standards of which we apply to a country that has a very healthy life, healthy lifestyle, a country that takes care of its citizens, is very well renowned over the world. And we're going to talk about how even in countries such as this one, not everything is as it seems. And then next week, we're going to take the opposite approach. We're going to examine a country which by any standard has a lot of problems. It's not a very safe country for both regular, it's very unsafe concerning regular crime and white collar crime. It has an international reputation as being one of the most corrupt places on earth. But once again, everything is not as it seems. And so I'm doing this because I want to shed a spotlight on two countries that really seem to be at opposite end of the spectrum. As I said, the first country we're going to discuss today is one which seems on its surface to be, I wouldn't say utopia, that's going way too far, but let's just say a nice place to live. The other one, a country that seems to be beset by problems all over the place, and as a result, has a very poor ranking, certainly in corruption and fraud index. Once again, not everything is as it seems. And before I get started, I want to make something very clear. I am not picking on or in any way, I do not mean to insult or degrade in any way to put down these two countries. I'm using them as examples to point out that the human condition, in this case, the human condition for fraud and white-collar crime is the same. You can have one country on one end of the spectrum that's on the surface, or even below the surface, seems to be a great place where everything is going fine, a happy place to live, but it still has problems. On the other spectrum, you can see a country that has multiple problems, is on the very low end of the spectrum. It's concerning, or I should say, is considered a very high-risk country concerning fraud and white-collar crime. But once again, not as all as it seems. There's hope to be found. And the purpose of this podcast, as I've said from the very beginning, is as an educational podcast. And it's my intent in these two podcasts to point out that the human condition is the same no matter where you are. And even in the most wonderful of all countries, there are still problems. And even in what seems to be the most horrible, well, that's too strong a word, in the most risky of all countries, there is always hope. And I hope certainly you enjoy these two podcasts. And once again, I certainly hope if anybody's listening from these two countries, you understand that my point here is to examine both sides of the same spectrum. So with that aside, let's start with country number one. And drum roll, please. But although if you've seen the title, it's not really much of a mystery. We're going to be talking about Iceland. I spoke about Iceland in a previous podcast concerning one of the earliest frauds in history, so it's kind of ironic. But we're going to be talking about Iceland. I do have a few listeners in Iceland. I want to thank you very much for listening to my podcast. I guess the word is talk theater, whatever. Anyway, thank you very much. Iceland is a very unique country by many in many respects. First of all, the language that's spoken in Iceland, Icelandic, it's a language that's over 1,000 years old, and it hasn't changed much during that time. I don't speak Icelandic, but from what I understand, a speaker of modern Icelandic can pick up a book that was written centuries ago in old Icelandic and still read it. The Icelanders are famous for, during the Middle Ages, having written down their history of their country in both, let's say, actual history, actual recorded events, and let's say expanded history, if you want to call it that. And they were written down in the sagas. These were written down in the 12th and 13th centuries. And as I said, it's my understanding that a speaker of modern Icelandic has no problem reading these texts, very little problem. As a counterexample, for example, if you want to take up English as an example, try reading Beowulf, which is written about 800 AD. Try reading Beowulf in the original. Good luck. Beowulf is written as what's called Old English or Anglo-Saxon. And Beowulf is, unless you've had training in Anglo-Saxon or Old English, it's virtually incomprehensible. Fast forward a few centuries to a period we call Middle English, where you have, say, the Canterbury Tales, which is written in Middle English. And an educated English speaker can read the Canterbury Tales, but you need a dictionary, and it's quite hard to piece them all together. And then you have the entry into modern English, which began about 1600 with the works of William Shakespeare. And even with those works, most people have a hard time following it. So Iceland is unique in that it's kept its language from changing over 1,000 years. I also understand that Icelandic has several features that remain with the language that have dropped out from other Scandinavian languages, such as Danish and Swedish. They still use a case system, which we use in Russian, for example. And they use patronymics, for example. They don't use last names. So it's my understanding that if your name is John and your father's name was John, you are John Johnson, and that's your name. You have the same thing in Russian as well, except those are for middle names. So it's a very unique environment. Iceland was settled in the 800s by Vikings, and Icelanders actually went on to discover Greenland, as we discussed in another podcast, and even went on to discover North America in about the year 1000. So maybe we should be celebrating Leif Erikson Day instead of Christopher Columbus Day. So it's a very unique culture and civilization, and it was a part of Denmark for centuries. It became independent in 1944, and since then it's become a country with a very, very high GDP, a very high standard of living. Much of that is due to the fact that Iceland has a lot of wealth surrounding in terms of its the fisheries. The fishing used to be a very big part of the Icelandic economy. Excuse me. As far as I know, it still is. Iceland is also very fortunate in that it gets a lot of its energy from geothermal sources, underground heat sources, volcanic sources. So I guess from what I understand, heating homes in Iceland, heating businesses is not that expensive because literally you can just dig in the ground and get your energy from there. I realize I'm simplifying a lot of things, but I want to point out that Iceland, by many objective standards, really is a nice place to live. As a matter of fact, it's my understanding as well that Iceland has a lot of greenhouses where they actually export fruit and vegetables to the rest of Europe because they can grow it there very easily because of the same geothermal source. So it's really impressive in that respect. Iceland also has a very, very good... let me back up for a minute. Iceland also has had a parliamentary democracy for thousands of years, certainly since the 800s. It's never really had a king, from my understanding, unless it was a part of the Kingdom of Denmark or Norway, where, of course, it's had that kind of king. But the Icelanders themselves never had a monarchy. And certainly since 1944, when it became independent, Iceland has been a democracy, a full-fledged democracy. And once again, it's my understanding that Icelandic civilization has had a democracy from the very beginning. I believe they had a parliament called the, I'm going to screw up the pronunciation, Althing, something like that. If anybody from Iceland is listening to me, I apologize for butchering your language. I understand it's a very beautiful language. Sorry about that. But I'm pointing this out because Iceland, by many, like I said, objective standards, is a very nice place to live. It has these wonderful features that have given it sort of a edge up in comparing it to the rest of the world. Good energy sources, and Icelanders themselves are from what I understand, are 100% literate. That is to say, 100% of the population can read and write. And not only that, Icelanders themselves have a holiday around Christmas, or maybe it is Christmas, I don't know, where they actually give books away and you're supposed to spend the night reading them, which I think, by the way, is a great idea. So if that's what you guys do in Iceland, congratulations. You've got two thumbs up in my book. And Icelanders themselves actually write stories that are read by the population. So it's, like I said, it's a very unique place. And I'm pointing this out to show that Iceland, by any objective standard, has a very large number of, for lack of a better term, blessings in that country that may not occur in other countries. Now, of course, not even by objective standards, not all is well and good in Iceland. Iceland is cut off from the rest of Europe. It's about the halfway point between Europe and North America. Because of that, there were several instances of famines in Icelandic history. The weather can get severe, even with the North Stream current, which does go flow through the around the country. Until very recently, it was cut off for so long that the people were actually quite poor. But with modern communications, modern technology, modern, of course, the internet and transportation, Iceland is now very much a part of the world economy. And also, it's, I understand that tourism is now a big part of Iceland's economy. My family was intending to visit this summer, but we actually had a vote and decided to go to Portugal instead. So maybe next year we'll go to Iceland. So as I said, it is a very unique country, and by these objective standards, it has a lot going for it. Now, one of the things that, to bring us into our discussion, Iceland is also very highly ranked in corruption. What I mean to say is that Iceland has a very, very low instance of corruption. There is a very secure law enforcement system in place. Icelandic banks are thought to be secure, known to be, or we'll get to that in a minute, were thought to be secure. There have been a hiccup. We'll talk about that. But Iceland has seemed to be a good place to invest money. Icelanders themselves have a very high level of education, as I've already pointed out. So it's a very strong and educated workforce, which contributes to the Icelandic economy. So, and as I record this episode in 2023, Iceland, for all intents and purposes, is a great candidate to shine a spotlight on as a great place where white-collar crime is not tolerated, where corruption is not tolerated. It's held up as an example to the rest of the world, just how transparent its legal system is, how transparent its investment systems are, how its banks are very well run. And as I said, it has that very... That aura, and with good reason, of being a very safe place to invest and do business. And by the way, obviously, any kind of investment in doing business in Iceland, as in any other country, involves other costs such as transportation, finding skilled workers, that sort of thing, immigration, visa issues, that sort of thing. But the Icelanders themselves are ranked very well in the corruption indexes of the world. That is to say, their country is regarded very highly as a country in which it's safe to do business. There's very low instances of corruption. And by and large, the population is very well secure in its sovereign funds and its internal funds. And the Icelanders who make deposits in Icelandic banks are secure that their money is secure in there. In terms of crime, other than white-collar crime, Iceland is considered, once again, a very, very low crime area. I think there was actually a murder that occurred there a couple years ago, and it shocked the nation. Interesting fact, Iceland is a member of NATO, but Iceland does not have an army or navy. Although, interestingly enough, they do have a special forces, which participated in NATO actions in Afghanistan. Not really sure how that came about. But once again, it's just a nice place. Let's just leave it at that. So we're spotlighting Iceland as the place where, theoretically, there's very little white-collar crime, very little crime at all, a great place to invest your money, a transparent legal system, a very secure legal system. It's a country with very little or almost no corruption, that is to say. And that's not me talking. That's organizations which actively monitor and report on countries. And once again, Iceland always comes out near the top as one of the safest places in which to live and do business and invest your money. But, and we all knew this but was coming. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing this podcast. Iceland is no paradise. It's no utopia. It's no Shangri-La. And a few years ago, they had a banking scandal that almost destroyed their economy. So how did this happen? How did it happen that in a country like Iceland, which like I said, has this reputation and well-deserved reputation as being a safe place to invest your money and do well. How is it that Iceland had a banking crisis that almost destroyed its economy? Well, there's been quite a few articles written about this, and there's actually a new book out that discusses this. I've gotten part of the book. I've read part of the book itself, the person who's investigated this, by the way, actually was told he had to stop investigating because he just wasn't getting more cooperation. But the book I'm talking about was written by a gentleman by the name of, let me see here. Oh, I'm not going to screw up his name as well. The person's name was Jared Bibler, Bibler. And he was appointed by the Icelandic markets regulator to uncover the truth behind the 2008 Icelandic financial crisis, which saw these national banks collapse. And he was finally able to write a book about it. And it's really fascinating. So what happened? Why is our country of Iceland for a while in the spotlight as suddenly being one of the worst places to do business? Well, Iceland itself, the country itself, we're going back to 2008 here. The Icelandic banks, and I'm not going to try and pronounce the names of these banks. Once again, I don't speak Icelandic, and there's other sources out there to review them. But Icelandic banks created a crisis where they tried to lure in foreign investors. Now, I guess we can go back and talk about how this is a common theme for any country, where a country wants to lure in money to have foreigners invest in their country, even a country that's as wealthy as Iceland. And they did this by offering investors from the Netherlands and the United Kingdom 15% interest rates. Now, that's, of course, a very high interest rate, and certainly most financial planners would jump at the chance to get something like that. And one of the interesting things about Iceland that allowed them to offer these rates was that Iceland has its own currency, although it's part of, I don't know if it's part of the EU, but even if it is, it has its own currency called the krona. And the value of Iceland's currency, the value of the krona, was very high during this time in 2008, and they were able to offer this these outstanding interest rates, which, of course, once again, seemed like a safe bet. And there were many, many investors from the UK and from the Netherlands who invested in this. And the krona actually became a major trading currency during this time, which is pretty spectacular when you consider that Iceland only has a population of about 350,000 people. And so for a country like this to be able to have that kind of power behind its currency really was, it's pretty amazing in and of itself. But it allured investors from the Netherlands and from Great Britain. And unfortunately, the Icelandic banks themselves did not invest these, did not make a lot of good investments in this. The banks use these deposits to invest in foreign companies, real estate, and sometimes even sports teams. And the amount that they invested, there was at one point over $100 billion in deposits invested in these Icelandic banks. And in 2008, when this whole thing happened, when the crisis happened, the actual value of Iceland's GDP itself, gross domestic product, was about $18 billion. So here you have $100 billion in deposits for a country that has about $18 billion in its GDP. And that really, I mean, that in and of itself is amazing in and of itself. Now, there are some articles which you can read out there which show that this alone should have been a bellwether or proverbial canary in the coal mine, that something is up when you have this much money invested in banks in a country that doesn't have the GDP to match it. But for those of us who survived the 2008 financial crash, really the sky was the limit, and a lot of people were not really paying attention to what was going on at that time. So in 2008, you know, these investments started to occur between 1997 and 2008, the UK investing into the UK and Netherlands and other countries, by the way, but I'm just using these two because they were the highest investors, began investing in these Icelandic banks. And then, of course, the 2008 financial crisis came along. But we'll get to that in a minute. But because there were so many deposits, this also drove up, and because the amount of deposits into Iceland actually exceeded the GDP of the country itself, the value of the krona, the Icelandic currency, was driven up 900% between 1994 and 2008. And this, of course, created inflation. The, you know, the standard definition of inflation is too many dollars, or in this case, krona, chasing too many goods. And the Icelandic Icelandic stock market skyrocketed almost 1,000% between 2003 and 2004. And by 2006, the average Icelander himself or herself was about 300% wealthier than they were in 2003. So you had this vicious circle of inflation. You had money just literally pouring into this country, cheap money that was available to Icelanders themselves. And the Icelanders themselves, many Icelanders were adding second mortgages using cheap foreign currencies. And as this went on, of course, at some point it was bound to come crashing down. But what really precipitated the entire house of cards to come crashing down was the financial crisis of 2008. And I don't have time to talk about it in this episode, and that's not really the point of this episode. But when this happened, the banks of Iceland just completely collapsed, the three major banks of Iceland. And the banks went bankrupt. Now, the government couldn't bail them out because they quite simply didn't have the money. And when these banks collapsed, they brought down the entire economy with them. If you can imagine, and once again, this is where you have a situation where a country like Iceland, with only 350,000 people, has this much money flowing into it, and yet their entire monetary system is built up from these rather insane amounts of money flowing into the country, not being supported by anything other than the Icelandic banks themselves, and the Icelandic banks relying on or quasi-relying on the value of the krona to prop up the currency. At some point, that's a recipe for disaster. And once again, when the 2008 crisis, economic crisis hit, many countries were affected, but Iceland was especially affected. And the whole thing, like I said, all these banks collapsed and caused the Icelandic banks to took down the Icelandic economy with them. So from what I understand, this really created a financial crisis in Iceland. There were many Icelanders who went broke because of this. And there were suggestions during this time that Iceland join the European Union. Well, I guess that answers my question, but that Iceland join the European Union and adopt the euro as a currency. Iceland did not do that. In 2009, the Icelanders themselves elected a new prime minister. And this prime minister, once again, I'm going to screw up the name, Jóhanna Sigurðardóttir, whatever. Once again, my apologies to my Icelandic listeners. She barred capital from leaving the country and prohibited citizens from buying foreign currency and foreign stocks. And as a result, the Icelanders themselves were forced to buy into the country themselves. Now, I'm not an economics expert. I'm not going to state whether that was a good idea or a bad idea, but it certainly helped to bail out Iceland. And what this also had another effect in that the currency exchange rate plummeted and suddenly became a lot cheaper to visit Iceland. And beginning in 2010 and 2011, tourism picked up in Iceland because the currency was so devalued. The currency was so low. Iceland became a very cheap place to visit. Also, it's my understanding that there was volcanic eruptions in Iceland, I think, in 2010 and 2011 as well. And this also helped, this enticed people to visit Iceland. So here we have a situation where a country which by its very nature, or certainly for the way it was viewed in the world, was as a completely safe investment. But then for these reasons I've discussed, you had hundreds of billions of dollars flowing into a country that really was in no position to support that kind of currency. The Icelandic banks themselves making, let's put it very gently, questionable loans. And in a country itself where the currency is rising so fast, this causes inflation. And this, sooner or later, as I said, something would have happened. But when the 2008 economic crisis hit, that was the trigger. Now, the 2008 economic crisis hit all countries hard, including the United States. But as we can see, Iceland was extremely hard hit by this because of the mistakes that the banks made. And it really, like I said, transformed by Iceland, at least for a time. Now, it's interesting, and this is where we're getting back to Iceland being perhaps a unique place, a safe place. The Icelandic authorities themselves developed a policy of accountability, and the principles of this policy was to establish the truth and punish those responsible. There was an independent truth commission that was created by the government, and an independent office, a special prosecutor, was established to actually prosecute these crimes. And in 2010, a massive report was published, about 2,300 pages, which detailed the financial findings of the, which detailed the findings of this collapse. And of course, in Iceland, it became an incredible bestseller. I've looked through parts of it, obviously the parts that were translated. And the Icelandic authorities themselves went on a tear to prosecute bank executives that were responsible. That the Office of Special Prosecutor said was responsible for this crisis. And a total of about 40 bank executives were successfully prosecuted, which is amazing because that's far more than any other country. So using this as an example, using Iceland as an example here, we see a case where you have a country which was wealthy, still is wealthy, by the way, but was not immune from, I guess, not to put a fine point on it, but was not immune from the basic urge of human greed. And between 2003 and 2008, this created a situation where there were a multitude of factors. As I said, but one of the main factors was the insane amount of money flowing into Icelandic banks, which were not properly regulated, which were not properly doing their due diligence in investments, which was creating multiple effects, such as the inflation we talked about. And when a financial crisis hit, this had the effect of just absolutely wiping out the Icelandic economy. Now, obviously, Iceland has recovered. As I speak here in 2023, Iceland is still a nice place. The country seems to be doing fine. Certainly, its tourism has not stopped in any way. But it's interesting from our viewpoint, where we can have a country like Iceland, which can be held out to the rest of the world as a safe place to do business. And yet, certainly, at least for a time, in this case, between 1997 and 2008, Iceland was actually built up on a house of cards for reasons that are all too familiar with other countries. Was there corruption? By Icelandic standards, there certainly was corruption. By other country standards, well, maybe not. But certainly the banks were not doing their job. There was not enough oversight concerning all the investments that these banks were doing. And the effects from the money flowing into Iceland were not regulated, not analyzed, or certainly could be expected, such as the inflation we talked about. And this created a situation where for a small country, at least for a time being, their entire banking system was wiped out. I'm sure this created hardship and difficulties for not some or all Icelanders, but even though Iceland has rebuilt its system, I guess we can say it serves as a stark warning that even in the most secure, even the most temperate, even the most well-regarded society, when it comes to white-collar crime and economics, there is still danger. Now, I didn't invest in any Icelandic banks. I don't know anybody who did, but I'm sure in the UK and the Netherlands and other countries that invest in these banks, they had issues as well and had to explain to their investors what happened to their money, how it suddenly disappeared. Also, one of the articles I read concerning this had an interesting point. Icelandic, we talked about the language earlier, is only spoken by about 350,000 people and maybe 10 or 20,000 others who learn the language. Well, that creates sort of a special case where if you have a language and you're investing in a country where not too many people speak the language, especially back then when Google Translate didn't exist, you're sort of at the mercy of a select group of people who are filtering information to you. After all, if you want to find out what's going on in your investments, you have to have an Icelandic speaker. And even today with Google Translate, certainly I would not trust them, a Google translator, to tell me what is going on. I would want somebody who is fluent in the language to interpret it for me. And this created a unique situation in and of itself, where what was going on in Iceland was murky to the investors, not only for financial reasons, but for linguistics reasons. And that in and of itself creates a very unique situation. So we're going to leave off here. Once again, I'd like to thank you for listening to my podcast. And I just need to repeat again, I'm not picking on Iceland, and I'm not picking on the country next week that I'm going to talk about. I'm using them to serve as examples, in this case, of a country that's well thought of in terms of the risks of white-collar crime, the risks of any kind of crime. It's a very, very safe country, but no country is immune from human nature and from economic forces. Next week, we're going to take the opposite approach. We're going to spend the first part of the program talking about the country that has a lot of pitfalls, a lot of issues concerning its white-collar and fraud issues. It's one of the worst countries in the world considered in which to do business, but all is not lost. There are a lot of bright spots going on in that country, and we'll talk about it, like I said, in 2 weeks. Hope everybody enjoyed this. I hope your 2023 is going well, and I look forward to speaking with you next week.